to make sure we have lots of water during the day and we stay hydrated. We want to make sure we don't skip meals and we try and eat a healthy diet. We want to make sure we sleep an adequate number of hours on a regular basis, which sometimes can be challenging when you're a young person. And we want to make sure that we exercise regularly, because the stronger our body is and the healthier we are, the better it is to cope with any illness. So there's healthy habits, there's adherence to healthy habits, figuring out how you can fit those in your day. There's school notes that help you work with your school so you can get treatment right away and you don't run into roadblocks. If you think about it, a lot of that's about confidence and plans.
Nothing can make a parent feel more helpless than seeing their child in pain. Why is it so difficult to get the right diagnosis and treatment for our children with migraine? Migraine has been reported in kids as young as 18 months old. Half of those with migraine had their first attack before the age of 12. Childhood migraine can seriously affect the child's quality of life. What do parents absolutely need to know about the unique challenges of migraine in children and teens? Dr. Scott Powers is a pediatric psychologist and an expert on pediatric migraine. We're fortunate to have him here with us today to provide some answers and hope. Dr. Powers, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thanks, Wendy. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're so glad to have you.
Thank you.
I'm going to start out with a question from our community. Gwen wrote in and said, both my mom and I developed migraine at around age 10, but had unexplained stomach problems prior to that going on into our teens. Now I have a son of a similar age, and there are a few warning signs that he might develop migraine too. So how does migraine present in children, and at what age does it start to be observed?
That's a great question. And it can start early in life for some children, particularly if many members of the family know they have migraine. That's sort of one of your first indicators to say, well, I'm seeing some symptoms in my young child that look like they could be migraine-like, like stomach problems or vertigo or dizziness when driving. And if you have a family history, that might be a good time to start talking to your pediatrician. A lot of times for children that we see in clinic, they've started their headaches somewhere around 8 or 9, but they may not even get to us until they're 11 or 12. So they've had headaches even during primary school before they hit the teenage years. But it can begin pretty much any time during childhood.
Okay. Well, good to know. You know, and what are some of the additional signs and symptoms? You mentioned a couple of them.
Yeah, the main things to think about, if you're having head pain that's throbbing or pounding, if it limits their activity, especially from a parent's perspective. So if you see them slowing down or they actually self-limit activities because the pain gets worse, those are two of the cardinal signs. There are other features to make a full diagnosis, but a throbbing, pounding pain that's pretty intense, at least for some of the headaches, and that limits your activity are some of the main things to look for as a parent. In addition, going into a dark room or staying away from noises. So some photophobia, some phonophobia. But for your children that are maybe in the primary school years, it might be more your observation as a parent of what you see them doing in response to their head pain. As we get into adolescence, it's a little bit more likely to have a dialogue for them to explain what those symptoms feel like to them or what's limiting them.
So it almost sounds like it could be a behavioral as well as it is kind of a physical thing. You notice the behavior changes in your own child.
Definitely. And especially the sort of staying away from activity. That's something that in the diagnostic criteria can be observed versus reported in pediatric migraine.
How many children and adolescents are affected by migraine?
Migraine is one of the most common chronic illnesses of childhood and is often underrecognized and underappreciated. In young children, pre-puberty, it's about 10% of youth, somewhat equally divided between boys and girls. In the pubertal years into later adolescence, it tends to be more often in females than males. And by the time someone's in the age range where they could be going to college or they're right out of high school, a very good epidemiologic study in Poland showed that it may be 1 out of 4 young women have migraines in that age group.
Wow. Is it difficult to get a diagnosis? And if so, why is that?
It's getting better.
Okay.
I think because of educational efforts by a lot of organizations and grassroots and advocacy organizations as well, like all the people listening today. Pediatricians are becoming a little bit more aware of migraine and asking more questions. But there still is a very few number of pediatric headache specialists, at least in the United States. And I think that's true around the world. And many neurologists, while they might be familiar with the concept of migraine, we might even have delayed diagnoses in that group. So I think to make it better, it's just education of everyone and having everyone that works in schools, teachers, pediatricians, as well as parents and families be more aware of its prevalence so that it's one of the first questions asked if someone who's young is complaining of head pain.
How is migraine diagnosed in children? And is the process different, you know, versus an adult or even adolescent diagnosis?
Yes, there's certainly some similarities, but there's some differences. So the diagnosis is still based on the International Classification of Headache Disorders. There are a few things that are allowed to look at young children that can get a diagnosis. So the duration of the headache doesn't have to be as long as it is in adults. It can be down to a 2-hour duration when non-treated, and it's 4 hours for adults. But generally speaking, the associated symptoms, the pounding, throbbing pain, the moderate to severe intensity, the interruption of activities or having to stop because the headache is worse are similar between adults, adolescents, and children. One of the main things that's different in pediatrics is really focusing on your interview with the child who has the headache. So you certainly need to talk to parents as well because they give you context. But learning how to interview a young person and get information from them around how their body's feeling, as well as doing your neurological and your physical exams, are things that really are more pediatric specific. And one of the nice things is in the American Headache Society, a lot of times there's meetings where physicians and other healthcare providers are taught by specialists some of the nuances of taking care of young people as compared to later adolescents and adults.
One thing that makes me think of too is a lot of young people present with abdominal problems as well, right? Or stomach problems. I think we're going to get into that during the course of the interview, but that might be something else parents could look for. Is that right?
Certainly. And sometimes the abdominal problems can precede episodes later where there's pain involved as well. So certainly talking to your pediatrician or family practice doctor, it may be a combination of seeing a gastroenterologist and a neurologist as well as a headache team over time to really tease out what is happening. But I would go back to if there's someone else in your family that has migraines, which is probably about 80 to 85% of the time true for young people, that's where you might say, well, it could be something that's genetic runs in our family. Let's go check that out as well. And you might even do that before you pursue more invasive procedures in the GI world where they might be doing scopes and other kinds of things to look at abdominal type of problems. You might say, well, let's see the neurologist first and see what they say before we go through a bunch of testing that might not be as pleasant for the young person. I would recommend that for sure.
That's a great suggestion. You know, and why is it so important to get a diagnosis?
Couple things. If you're a person who's having pain, understanding what that pain is caused by is certainly a relief. And when you think about young people and children and their development, you know, life can either be good or it can kind of be yucky. And there's not a whole lot of in between. So if you get nervous about something or you feel like maybe someone didn't believe you or think something was serious, it can kind of weigh on your mind and affect you as a young person. So having someone really listen to you, really have an interview with you as the person whose head is hurting, and then give you information about how common this problem is, how we can get it better if we work together in smart ways, can be so reassuring for a young person. And it gives them a name. Oh, I have migraine. My Uncle Tommy has migraine. So they say, I'm going to get better. And they say a lot of kids have this. That's a lot of information to have if you're a 12 to 13-year-old person versus, I don't know, the doctors don't know what they're talking about and they don't tell me what's going on. So you can really think about what the difference is in terms of understanding your pain condition and getting a plan to get better versus being in the unknown.
And letting that pain continue and then perhaps even worsen over time. So yeah, absolutely. Well, is migraine in children very well studied or very well researched? I know that you've written a number of papers on this topic, but in general, is it well researched?
It's another we're getting better question and answer. It's not as well researched as it should be given its prevalence or its impact on quality of life. That's true in adults as well. But so much in medicine, you start with adults, and then if you test an intervention in adults, then you try it in children. At Cincinnati Children's, we sort of try to flip that upside down and say, if you have a chronic illness, neurological disorder like migraine, and you're 8, then we need to start doing research then. So our clinic and our team is very actively engaged in research studies of all kinds. And we really partner with families and young people when they come in and say, we have pretty good tools to get you better now, but we're constantly trying to get more knowledge to help kids in the future. Would you be willing to partner with us and listen to some of our research studies you could participate in? And it's just tremendously uplifting the way kids and families are like, yeah, I want to help other people. What can we do to learn more while we're taking care of you today? So the research in the last 10 years is really increasing. The interest in the American Headache Society of the number of people showing up to the pediatric adolescent special interest section is bursting out the seams of the door of the room, pre-COVID, of course, from what we had 10 years ago. So I'm very optimistic about the future of the knowledge we're going to gain to help kids and families.
Oh, that's just great news. I'm so glad to hear that. And you certainly talked about this with genetics, but I would just like to go back a little bit too, to what are the risk factors for children having migraine?
In terms of genetics and being a family-based disorder, usually someone in the immediate family has symptoms of migraine. So mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, someone in that area might have had symptoms of migraine. Occasionally it can be further back in the family, and maybe it's a generation or two ago, and maybe it was like, yeah, my great-grandma had sick headaches all the time. So she may not ever have had a diagnosis, but she might have gotten nauseated and go to a dark room and having headache pain. And you're like, sounds like migraine to me. So it's not always the case. Like I said, 15 to 20% of the young people we see in our headache center don't have an immediate relative that has migraine. And maybe it's the first time it's happened in their family. But generally speaking, it does run in families.
And parents have told us that their child's migraine disease worsened after a concussion or a traumatic brain injury. Can you talk about that as a risk factor as well?
Sure. And you can certainly understand the reason for that, right? Even some really serious viral illnesses of someone who's predisposed to have migraine might be something that gets the body reacting genetically and genomically to sort of those risk factors in their genetics. So even a really serious illness that gets you down and has bad headaches might be a precursor to your migraine starting. But concussions in particular will cause some headache themselves. And usually young people recover from that within a few weeks, but sometimes it lingers. Many times if you've had migraines before, concussions can be a little bit more likely to have post-concussive headaches that linger long-term. But in some ways it's probably the migraine phenomenon just continuing to happen, but your body had an insult that might have perturbed the way the brain is processing information for a while.
And when in the more severe cases, regardless of the start of it, I guess, when should you consider an ER visit or push for an MRI?
Those are great questions. You know, I think it's really important. One of the real values in our healthcare system, even though it has a lot of things that need to be better, is the relationship the family has with their primary care doctor. So really relying on talking to your pediatrician or family doctor about, these are the symptoms we're seeing. What's our game plan? Do you think I need to see a neurologist? Do I need to see an interdisciplinary team so that we can come up with a game plan? Because it is definitely true in the way we think about acute care that if we've tried good acute treatments that you can do in your home and we're not having any success at all, we do have a day program where kids can come in and see us and they see the headache specialist. But if it's 8 o'clock at night, we work with our partners and our colleagues in the emergency department so that they have an algorithm of how would you go about treating someone who's 14 with a migraine that hasn't gone away for a day, that's really tried some over-the-counter medicines, maybe some prescription acute medicines. So going to the ER with a plan with your pediatrician, I think is the best way to think about that. Imaging is an interesting issue in migraine because there's sort of two ways to think about that. The doctor might do a full neurological exam and really do a careful history. And generally speaking, most of the times with migraine, that's going to satisfy them that there's not a major concern structurally that they're looking for. So we do not do an awful lot of imaging in our headache center because I think we do such thorough investigation and we do so much of this. However, under the age of 6 or 7, where maybe the history from the young person isn't quite as clear because you're just younger and it's hard to describe your feelings, we will oftentimes think about an MRI then. We'll also think about it if there's no family history, because if 85% is family history and it's not, are you looking for other potential concerns? The second part, though, is more about reassurance and what do we need to know as a patient and a family to not worry about things that might be scary to us. So we don't necessarily do imaging just for that reason, but it is a conversation to have with your provider. You know, say, well, if we did this, what would that rule out? Do you think that would be worth the investment to look at that based on your exam? But don't be surprised if a lot of pediatric headache specialists might say, given everything we've looked at, that is not something I'm concerned about today. I want to go ahead with treatment at this time. So, and there are a lot of papers written now showing that imaging probably isn't super necessary if you get a really good neurological exam and history. Now, anything unusual in a neurological exam, a neurologist is certainly going to do further workup and explain that to you if they're doing their job well.
Great. That makes sense. And back to the ER visit or potential ER visit, I think that advice makes sense for adults as well. You know, so you should have a plan. Think ahead if, you know, you get to such a point of severity, what you're going to do, have talked about it with your neurologist in advance. So I think that's great advice for all of us, actually.
And also, you might even have a plan that you and your neurologist develop. So you take a paper in that the doctor signed that says, you know, this is generally what we've tried before we came. This is what we'd recommend when we get there, because certainly the use of powerful pain medications like opioids is not necessarily the evidence-based treatment if you go into an ED to get treated, particularly in young people. But I think that's also true of the literature that's evolving in adulthood.
Well, I think too, just as a parent myself of two children who've exhibited migraine, that gives me a lot of comfort to know that I could have a plan if we got to that point where things were so scary, you need to go to the ER, that you do have that plan. I think that would give you some control over the situation.
Yes, and that's another example where we need to do more research. I don't know that we really have the best evidence of exactly what you'd do if your migraine didn't respond to your over-the-counter and your other prescription medicines. So there is some evolving literature that's showing some agents that can be done through IVs are effective. And I think we just need to continue to learn more as we do that.
Well, let's kind of talk a little bit about the most common types of migraine in children. And certainly we've touched on this, but if you could just walk us through the most common types that that you see.
Sure. It kind of goes back to that diagnostic question. If you look at the epidemiologic studies that have been done, human beings, by the time they're 15 or 16, probably 8 out of 10 have had a headache. That's also a reason why there might be some stigma and people don't believe you as quickly, because if everyone's experienced something and you say you're having a headache, they might say, well, it's just a headache. I've had that. And that's not what a migraine is. And it's not what some of the other headache disorders are that are quite painful. But if you are having, like I said, the throbbing, pounding, moderate to severe pain, that's a pretty good example of what those symptoms are going to feel like in a practical sense. And you're having the headaches. And migraine is the most common in terms of a diagnosis for primary headaches. But there's also headaches that can be described as tension type headaches that are more tight and mild, more like a rubber band around your head, and more mild pain. Some people may get that from posture. You might have been sitting at your computer during this pandemic all the time and you notice your shoulders are kind of tight and you have some discomfort in your head. Most of us have probably experienced some type of tension headache, even if it's related to a bad flu where our bodies might be having musculoskeletal pain. And that might be more common, but actually the more you're looking at the epidemiology and the more that people are thinking about the pathophysiology of migraine, it may be that tension headaches and migraine headaches are more on a continuum than they are totally opposite biological entities. But migraine is the most common headache disorder in young people, but there are also other rarer primary headache disorders that neurologists and headache specialists can better understand and explain to you. But generally speaking, if it's throbbing, pounding, hurts pretty good, keeps you from activities, there's a really good chance that the diagnosis is going to be migraine. You can also have auras, visual. Auras are relatively common in young people. They can happen before the head pain or coincident with it. And it may not happen for every headache. And then based on frequency of headache, the doctor might refer to you as having more episodic headache versus chronic headache. Those are probably more useful to the way physicians think about diagnosing than they are to you as a person. If you're having headaches, if they're interrupting your life, they're too frequent. But it is true that you can start out with maybe a headache a week and they're migraine-like. And over time, without good treatment, you might get to the point where they transform into more frequent, even up to more than 15 days per month, which is just a miserable experience for anyone. But one, we can get better. So even if it's high frequency, don't feel like as a family or as a young person that we can't help you get better. We've done studies that show we get a lot of kids better. The preponderance of kids, upwards of 90% better with chronic migraine, with combined medication and behavioral treatment.
That's great. That's great to know. You know, you mentioned auras. Are auras different in children than they are in adults?
Not generally speaking in terms of their physiology. And certainly the types of visual disturbances you can have are pretty similar. So generally speaking, not a whole lot of difference in presentation. They might be a little different in the way you describe them if you're 8 versus 14 versus 35, but generally speaking, not too different.
Okay. And going back, I wanted to circle back as well to abdominal migraine. Could you tell us just a little bit more about that? And maybe, you know, why does migraine tend to affect the stomach so much in children?
Sure. A little bit more of a descriptive term than generally an ICHD diagnosis, but important practically, because you can have some belly pain that might actually eventually develop into head pain with migraine later on and not necessarily a GI or gastrointestinal disorder. If you think about it ontologically, so if we think all the way back to the way we develop from the time that we become an embryo and then we become a fetus and then we become a person, the brain and the spinal cord and the gut all kind of come from the same developmental set of cells. What that means is there's a lot of nerve endings in your gut, just like there is in your brain and your spinal cord. That's why if even as adults who are listening, you know, if you've just had a, you know, maybe you just got a GI infection or you've got a stomach flu and you get gassiness in your GI tract and just how painful that can be. And you're like, gosh, I'm just having gas in my GI tract, but it feels like I'm going to like keel over and this is excruciating. It's because there's so many nerves in the gut. So in that way, if you think about the brain being maybe oversensitive in someone who has migraine to lower threshold stimulation, that might be true as well of your GI tract. And if it is, then maybe the same stimulation for someone with migraine may be more discomforting than someone without that. That's at least the theory that I think a lot of the people in headache medicine think about when they think about why would someone have abdominal pain that might be related to migraine.
Let's switch over to mental health. With adults, mental health is often a comorbid condition with migraine. And how common is depression and anxiety in children and adolescents with migraine?
This is a really great question because in some ways there's similarities, but there's so many differences. Kids do experience negative affect. And many times before their mid-adolescence, it might sort of be anxiety, depression, all balled up together kind of feeling. Something that you can separate out and describe differently as an adult. But there's no one that has pain that recurs, that's unpredictable, that's going to be in a great mood about it. And kids in some ways are very resilient as well. They have lots of good coping skills and we can teach them even more. So is it a burden and is it disabling to have pain that recurs? Yes. Even if you're just pushing through it and on the outside you look like you're coping great, it's still not easy. You might be expending a lot of energy to cope through that. There are certainly some young people and adolescents that really do develop comorbid mental health disorders in addition to migraine, and we can do a good job of diagnosing those and helping them. But the way I think about it is all young people with migraine need a coping skills toolkit. And if we start early and give you the coping skills and we have success, we're probably going to be less likely to have those other things develop related to your pain disorder. Doesn't mean you might not have depression later in life if you have a family history or if you have life events, but at least the pain disorder that gets under control and you understand cannot be something that's a risk factor for that. So be alert for it, but don't think that it's super common in young people. What we do see is maybe a little bit more anxiety symptoms than in the general population. Generally, depression is pretty similar in terms of its prevalence between people with migraine and people without migraine. But everyone's an individual. So it all depends on how am I doing, how's my family doing, and what's the best care I can get.
You know, speaking of coping and having coping strategies, one of our community members wrote in and asked, how can parents help children cope with feelings of loss and isolation, loss of friends, loss of activities and events when they're dealing with migraine disease?
That's a great question. And it is hard to watch. It's even harder to experience. Being a parent myself, you have a lot of sensitivities about people that you love that are your children. So it is hard to watch. At the same time, we do play a role as a coach in a young person's life. So thinking of ways to keep them active, be involved in things, seeking out those good professionals who can give you a clear diagnosis, a clear treatment plan so you can start to get better. And then as you get better, really reinforcing the efforts by the young person to go try things. Because if you have intermittent pain, even if you're starting to get better, you might be worried about the football game Friday night. And just sympathy alone and empathy isn't going to necessarily help. If I'm dad talking to you on a Wednesday, knowing that you're worried about getting a headache on Friday. But if we had a discussion about what are we going to do? What's our game plan? Tonight, tomorrow night, and ready for this weekend, because we're going to have a great weekend. We're going to get enough sleep. We're going to hydrate. We're going to do some of our exercise. We're going to get a good, healthy habit when it comes to eating regularly. We're going to do all the things the doctors have told us that we can be in charge of to be better. And then on top of that, I would likely have taught that young person some relaxation skills as part of their biobehavioral skills. And we'd say, we're going to really use those these next 3 days so that we're going into Friday with a real healthy set of circumstances and maybe prevent that migraine from happening. It's not 100% guaranteed, but it's a much more proactive attack it, go after it, want to get better with confidence than it is worry, wait, and see. And really coping's a lot about what can you be in charge of that you can do actively. And if we've done it well, more often than not, it pays off and you get a good outcome. So then you're like, that was a smart idea. It worked.
And then it reinforces that behavior. I love that. Again, I think it's strategies that are helpful for adults as well to kind of like pre-plan, you know, how you're going to stay as healthy as possible to get you to that event and having some strategies of, you know, and actually we're going to kind of move to that next. In fact, I won't steal your thunder. And let's talk about treatments.
Say one thing about that too.
Yeah, of course.
That question was very important. Let's say you do all that and it still didn't work. So how do you react to that? Certainly you have to appreciate, yeah, that's a loss. That was a bummer. It wasn't fair. And it's okay to have that time to say, you know, that wasn't fair. That just really was a bummer. All right. Let's take a deep breath. Let's do something fun together. Let's do something we enjoy that might be quiet and calming versus active, but something together to keep that relationship going, even if it's for the moment in a not very fun set of emotions. And then when you wake up the next day, you go, okay, new day. Model that behavior. New day. New opportunity. It's still Saturday, still the weekend. What would you like to do today? So I think you have to realize that there's the empathy part's important too, but the coaching part really becomes the thing that you have to sometimes work on if you're the caregiver, because you've got to summon your energy to do that when you're watching and feeling negative too. But sometimes you're the lead to get that rolling, to motivate that in young people.
Right. Just seems that will build resilience in your child over time too. So it's not a total loss, as you said. Well, let's kind of segue into treatments and how do children and adolescents get better? You know, you've conducted, as we mentioned, extensive research into cognitive behavioral therapy for pain reduction. Please tell us about it. What are the high level findings and why is it so important?
When you think about coping with a painful condition like migraine, almost everything has a behavior attached to it. So before I get to cognitive behavioral therapy, let's talk about how we think about biobehavioral conceptualizations of treatment. So if it's acute treatment, let's say it's ibuprofen, you still have to take it. You have to recognize your headache. You have to get it right away. So we do a lot of working with kids about different situations they're in to have a game plan of like, when I'm at school, what do? How do I prepare if I go to a friend's house? What if I'm at dad's house? What is the plan to catch that pain early, do something about it and see if you get better? So while there is a medicine that might be the agent that relieves the pain, the behaviors and the confidence in your behaviors and the ability to do them in different situations are all things we problem solve around. The healthy habits we talked about, might not be able to do them all perfect at the same time, but we want to make sure we have lots of water during the day and we stay hydrated. We want to make sure we don't skip meals and we try and eat a healthy diet. We want to make sure we sleep an adequate number of hours on a regular basis, which sometimes can be challenging when you're a young person. And we want to make sure that we exercise regularly, because the stronger our body is and the healthier we are, the better it is to cope with any illness. So there's healthy habits, there's adherence to healthy habits, figuring out how you can fit those in your day. There's school notes that help you work with your school so you can get treatment right away and you don't run into roadblocks. If you think about it, a lot of that's about confidence, and plans. I've got something I can do, and I'm confident I can do it. And if you have those two things going for you, in all likelihood, your headaches are going to get better across a number of different treatments we provide. And you have to be seeing people that truly care and believe you. You've got to have that trust. Like, no, Dr. Powers really believes me. He's going to stick with me until I get better. And my belief over 30 years of working with young people is that may be the secret sauce. If they really trust us, we're going to get them better. We may have to try different things, but if we stick with it, we're going to get them better. I think a lot of that confidence and that resilience in young people is important. Cognitive behavioral therapy is really like working with a coach. So it may not seem like, especially to you adults, like, oh, that's not therapy. No, it's not a bunch of talk therapy and what you see on TV. It's coaching. So we come in and we talk about how pain works in the body and how our brain relates to our nerves and that you actually have some control over pain. The example I give to young people is if you've ever been out playing really hard and you come in and your mom or dad goes, oh my goodness, you got some blood on your sock. And you're like, oh, I do. Well, you must have gotten scratched pretty good when you were out playing, but you didn't notice it at all. But if your parent said, hey, come here, I just need to scratch you a little bit. You'd be like, don't do that, that hurt. So your brain actually has the ability to turn on and turn off pain signals to some level. And if you start to think that you have some control over how your body responds, then you can learn some relaxation skills that help your body calm down in the nervous system. You can use biofeedback, which is a computer that kind of shows you. We take the temperature of your finger with this little piece of tape around your finger. When your body's really relaxed, the blood flow through your fingers goes up and your peripheral temperature goes up. When your body's relaxed, the muscles on your forehead relax. So we have these little, like white band-aids they stick on your forehead. They measure the muscle tension of your forehead. If you learn relaxation as a young person, you can start to see that relaxation response on the computer. And you're dealing with a pain disorder that maybe you don't feel like you have much say over because it's gotten pretty bad and it hurts a lot. All of a sudden you're working with me and I'm like, we got this. We're going to control our body. You're getting really good at that. And the relaxation response is counteracting to the pain response. In addition to that, we talk a little bit about activity pacing, especially in adolescence. You know, you have a really good day, so maybe you do overdo it, and maybe you don't do all your healthy habits, you stayed up too late, and the next day or the day after, you're like, oh, should have done that. Doesn't mean I don't want you to have fun, but I want you to know your body well enough so that you can titrate that. And then as we get you better and better, your stamina goes up, and you don't have to be thoughtful about activity pacing as much. And then there's a cognitive component, the cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's the fact that our thoughts and our feelings are related. So just the example we talked about before, if I'm worried about the big game Friday night, I might get myself so nervous about it and think about it so much that my body and my brain's like, well, I have migraines too. And you already got me all nervous. So I'm sensitive to stimuli. Boom, you had a thing happen on Thursday and then self-fulfilling prophecy. And on Friday, you get a migraine. So instead of having the thought recurring in your mind like Friday is going to be bad, I know it's going to be bad, it's going to happen again, it's happened before. It's like, hey, I've been keeping my diary, I'm working with the doctors, my headache frequency is down, I'm doing all the things I need to do. We'll just have to see how it plays out, but there's no reason to automatically believe it's going to be bad. So your feelings and your thoughts are going to be important parts of what we help you learn coping skills to be more of a active, confident manager of those things. And if you do those well, we do see cognitive behavioral therapy helps alone in reducing headache frequency and disability. And chronic migraine, as I mentioned before, 15 headache days or more a month. By a one-year follow-up, after 5 minutes of combined medication and cognitive behavioral therapy, 9 out of 10 young people had their headaches down to where they were about once a week. And they started at about 5 a week when they started the study. So it is probably the most evidence-based treatment for migraine right now in young people is a combination of a pill therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy.
So do you recommend CBT for everyone? Is it a match for everyone then?
I recommend learning relaxation skills to every person we see in the headache center. There are some apps available now that are free that can teach you some basic breathing and some muscle stretching exercises that relax the body. So I encourage all kids to take an active approach to learning at least a basic coping skill. And then in addition to that, if they want to in our clinic, they can come in and do a 1 hour biofeedback session where they get their own relaxation audio file made on their phone and they actually get to work with the computer and see how their body changes. And then for many young people, if your disability is kind of high, or if you're like, this is just bugging me, I need a coach for a while to get on to do it, we would recommend that for almost every young person if they're interested in learning it.
I think that sounds fascinating. It's something I want to look into too. You know, I wanted to come back to one thing. You did mention some lifestyle interventions or things that kids should be thinking about. But I know, especially for teens, that can be harder said than done. And you alluded to that as well. But Nicole specifically wants to know how we can get kids to accept their condition and really tune in to early warning signs so they can treat effectively. And I think this might be particularly the case with teens who want to just rush fast.
Yeah. And that's a skill just like everything else a young person's learning. And part of it's going to be developed through the school of hard knocks and experience. Some of it's going to come through knowledge and coaching from people that care about you. It is true. If you think about just the four healthy habits I mentioned, and you're a 15-year-old young person, you're like, wow, you want me to do all that? So we oftentimes sit down and have more of a discussion about where's your life at? What are you doing? What could you fit in? What can you not fit in? Homework's taking all hours of the night. Might be hard to get those 10 hours of sleep, okay? Can we hydrate while you're doing homework? So it really is a collaborative discussion with the young person about their life and what they can fit in versus a perfection approach. And then some prioritization. So the question that was asked about catching your pain early, I really do talk to young people and adolescents about why is it so vitally important as soon as your headache starts to do something. We talk about how pain can get revved up in the body. We talk about their own life experience, and I'll sit there and say, so can you tell me about when you've waited? How does that go? Have you ever caught it early? Many times young people say, yes, I did it go differently? So in some ways, it's a little bit, there's a technique called motivational interviewing, where you're just trying to elicit information from the person. And then from what they tell you, you kind of go, well, you thought about this. Well, what do you think would happen then? So you're not dictating to the person, thou shalt 15-year-old do this right now. You're more in this dialogue of discussing together what the consequences are, what the benefits are, what the costs are. And you're right. Sometimes in adolescence, you're like, the cost of doing that to be healthy is higher to me than the benefit. And I'm willing to take what I have to deal with it. And you're like, it's not illogical. You presented your point to me. Can you give one of these things a try? Or maybe the doc said this was the main thing to try. Can we develop a plan to get better at that? But as opposed to being frustrated as a caregiver, I think the key is to say, we're learning. They're learning skills you want them to adapt later. You want them to feel confident in the ones they use. So if all we do is dwell on the ones they're not doing versus the ones they are doing, then that doesn't make for a great interaction either. So praise the things that are going well, congratulate them on trying versus being perfect, and keep it up. You can keep it up without being totally naggy, but adolescents are kind of used to us adults being a little naggy. And if we weren't, they'd go, what's wrong with you, Mom? You care about me anymore?
That's right.
So you can even make humor part of it. Like, no, I really care a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's not my head, I know. And then especially, like you said, if in your family you have migraine, maybe you're the parent that has it. Model the behaviors. Kids watch. If they see you not doing the healthy habits, then gosh, why are you telling me to do that? So you really do have to sort of take a look in the mirror at times too and say, well, am I sort of role modeling the ways that to be healthy and sticking with plans and doing things? If I am, they're going to see it. And over time, observational learning will kick in over time as your young people get older. But I think a lot of it's about the dialogue over time, and don't see it as a one episode event. It's a learning event to get better at this. And none of us are going to be perfect at doing all these things.
No, but I do love the role, the coaching role that you're describing here, the coaching role that you would have with your provider, but you yourself can provide as the parent. I think that's a really helpful way to frame it.
And anything you see that's positive, anything you see, even if they're 17, it's fine to say, hey, Johnny, I saw what you were doing. That was really great. I know you're trying hard to get your headaches better. They might roll their eyes at you every once in a while, because if you said that to an 8-year-old, they might go give you a big hug. And at 18, they might be like, oh, okay. but they heard you. They heard you, and they heard exactly what you were observing. And it will stick with them, even if they don't make it obvious to you.
You know, we've talked about obviously some different treatments and even pairing treatments from something you said earlier, but you know, what are other treatment options that parents do have for their kids, and how are they different from adults?
So the good news is we're getting more and more knowledge about young people and what treatments can be effective. Still not enough. And it is very much true that responding to different treatments in young people is not the same as adults. So when I talked earlier about research starts with adults, and then maybe we downsize what we find to kids, in migraine, that's probably not the best model. We really need to understand and work with kids. So we did a study of the two most commonly used prevention medicines in pediatric by headache specialists. One's called amitriptyline, the other's called topiramate. We did this across the entire United States with 35 centers. It was a major study. We stopped that study early because neither medicine worked better than the placebo pill. But about 6 to 7 out of 10 kids got better. So it wasn't like, oh, nothing works. It's like, no, kids get better. We don't know why exactly. So if you're a physician today, if you go see a headache specialist, they may be very well likely to still give you a pill-based prevention medicine. But they'll do it in a lower dose, and they'll monitor side effects to make sure it's nothing negative happening. And hopefully we'll get that, whatever that effect is that's beneficial, we'll get that effect. And they'll be more likely to probably stop the medicine sooner than they would have before we had the details of this study. We just published a 3-year follow-up to that study, and no matter what you took, the two drugs or the placebo, 3 years later, the people that got better in 6 months were still doing better. So the great news is once you get better, I think we can keep you better. And we know that pill-based therapy, even nutraceuticals like riboflavin, have been shown in some studies that aren't tightly controlled scientifically, but reasonable studies, have low side effects and can have some benefit. But if you take the evidence today, I would certainly make sure you get a good diagnosis, you get a good acute treatment plan, because there's pretty good evidence for over-the-counter pain relievers and medicines that are in a class called triptans. Some of them are approved in young people and have been shown to be effective. Healthy habits. I would certainly learn some cognitive behavioral therapy skills, even if you don't go see the coach. I would build those coping skills into your plan. And then I'd work with your provider who can write prescriptions about what would be a pill-based therapy that would be reasonable to try and over what time. Some of the newer therapies that are more injectables and molecular-based, like antibody therapy, are being tested now in studies with young people. So we should, within the next 3 or 4 years, have some answers to if they're better than a placebo injection, because many of them are injectables. We'll have to see. And that's why we do research, to constantly learn what is better and what works. But it isn't the case that you can just take what you know as an adult headache provider and do the same thing with young people and expect the same results. That doesn't seem to be what the research is showing.
You know, we did get a few different questions about school and about helping your children in that setting. And I would, you know, one question I'd like to call out is, what advice do you have for parents who encounter resistance at school that could come from administration or teachers or maybe other kids? You know, how does stigma come into play, and how can parents really advocate for their child?
A couple things that we do in our headache center. First time we meet you and your family, we make sure there's a school note that we give you that we've signed. And there's not a young person that's ever left clinic that I haven't said to them directly, Sarah, tell me about your teachers. Tell me what you're worried about school. So first off, we put it right on the line and we talk about it candidly. And we listen carefully. So if Mrs. History teacher or Mr. Science teacher is the bugaboo, we're like, oh, okay. What's going to be our game plan for that hour? Do you feel like the other hours you go to the office right away? So we acknowledge the challenge and we come up with a plan. The other thing I tell them is, if you and mom and dad or your family talk to the people at school, you take the letter, and I want you to be present. So I tell every parent, I want the young person present when you talk to the vice principal, because it's their head. And that vice principal needs to see Sarah in front of them saying, she's telling me she needs help. And I always say to him, and if that doesn't work, see this paper we give you that's got Dr. Hershey and Dr. Powers and Dr. Kabush on it? See that phone number? You call me. And I deadly mean that. If they are having challenges, we'll call schools and we'll talk to the nurses. We'll talk to the principal. We'll explain that you wouldn't have a child with diabetes that you didn't let go to the office because they had low blood sugar. You need to let a young person with migraine go to the office and get their treatment. It's the same thing. They're no different. So we tend to be very candid, very direct, very clear. At the same time, understanding the environment and trying to have our ears open to what might be the challenges. Maybe that teacher doesn't believe it. That's a different question than they're just really strict and they don't like anybody to leave. And we can work with those types of things. But we have to have the young person with us working on them so that they feel enabled and they feel confidence and they feel like they can have an appropriate coping skill for that. Because maybe they're scared of that teacher. Well, I'm not in their shoes. I don't know what it's like to be scared when you're 14 of a teacher. I kind of remember what it was like to be 14, but not in the moment. I can't ask you to do things that are Herculean without giving you a good plan. So part of it's being able to really listen, but also being clear. The other thing is we're really clear with the young people. We see that we've set up a system of care that if you've had a bad migraine and you've tried everything at home, we have a day program. If it's not during the day, we have a hospital you can come to and we've got a plan you bring with you. So if you can't go to school, and it's that bad, then you need to come and see us to make it better. So we do very much actively encourage young people to get to school because that's their job, but have a plan to get treatment when they're there, have a plan if they can't make it, and work with their families. So it kind of goes back to that active coping mentality while still believing, yeah, this is hard. It's a pain condition. It's not easy. We are going to get you better. But that activation of doing things is really important. Now, that being said, we do see young people that they've kind of, you know, the hole's been dug pretty deep. Maybe they haven't seen people that have given them clear diagnoses. Maybe their treatments haven't been that great. And they're just feeling really not very confident and really upset, probably angry by the time we see them. And in those cases, we still have the same philosophy about going to school, but we also talk specifically about why there's a game plan and how that's different than it was before. Before, people, a bunch of adults were just saying, just get out of bed and go. We're saying, let's give you all the tools you need so you can try to go. And then if it doesn't work, what are we going to do to respond to that? So we still have that active approach, but we try to be quite empathic with what it must be like to have had that lived experience for a year or two before you might see us. So it really is a balancing act when it comes to those activities. But bottom line is, if you're 14, you have a couple of jobs. Go to school. Be kind to other people. And that's fundamentally what we want to teach and nurture in young people with chronic illness and people that don't have chronic illness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you answered my other question about school. And that is, how do you know when you should send your child to school? You know, if your child is in the middle of an attack, I know that I've heard other parents talk about that before, especially if your child gets very frequent attacks, you know, and how do you handle that?
Yeah, if that's happening, then we need to get better treatments. And we need to join together as a team and help that young person so we can start getting that normalization of life back, that confidence back, that in-between headache periods being happier than waiting for the next one. And it goes back to that point I made about got to believe them, you got to work together on a plan, and you got to stick with them. And if you do those things, then it's easier as a young person to say, yeah, I'm going to slug it out today and get there because I need to do this. And I've got people that have my back versus people that are like, what's your problem? Just do it. So you do have to be careful sometimes with your language, even when you're frustrated. It is hard work, but young people are more than willing to do hard work to feel better. They're very willing to do hard work.
Okay. I know I have a great resource too called Migraine at School. For those that are watching, you may want to check that out. It's a great program and there's a website. So that's a resource to offer for individuals. Sure. And, you know, as we conclude, I would just love to know, I mean, you've given us a lot of great messages today, but what message do you have for parents of children with migraine and maybe for those who felt like that they've tried everything? You know, what message do you have for them today?
I think my main message is you always have to have hope because there are people out there that can help. And the earlier we start, and the more education we have, so if migraine runs in your family, you get to the doctor earlier. You get that young person in with the people that know the literature and know the research and do the best care they can. The really good news is our evidence base as it's evolving says, once we get you better and you're younger, you have a high probability of staying better. We did the 3-year follow-up to the what's called the CHAMP study. We did a 1, 2, and 5-year follow-up of young people that just saw us in clinic about 15 years ago. And if we got you better 5 years later, you were generally staying better. Doesn't mean your migraines were gone. But your quality of life, your headache frequency were better. So the main thing is, even if you're struggling, even if it's gotten really intense, even if it's continuous headache, we have knowledge from what we've done clinically and research that says we can get you there. We can get your life back. We can get you better. And that's why educational sessions like this, societies like the American Headache Society, the American Migraine Foundation, many grassroots organizations, the more advocacy we have, the more people realize this is a chronic disease that is fairly frequent and prevalent in young people, the more we'll have resources to support the research and the care that's needed. So if we all row in the right direction and we do it together, then my main message is there's a tremendous amount of hope for young people. We know how to help you get better. Once you get better, you stay better. And your adult life with migraine, I believe, is going to be very different than if you didn't get those excellent treatments when you're younger.
That's a great message of hope and a great way to end this conversation. I have a feeling a lot of people that are listening to us today are going to want to learn more about you and follow your work. You know, where can they do that?
They can go to Cincinnati Children's Hospital's website and just put in my name, Scott Powers, and it'll come right up on our webpage to learn more about me. We also have a headache center webpage at cincinnatichildrens.org website, and they'll actually see some resources there and even some of the things we've developed through research.
Well, thank you so much. I believe that you have given parents just so much great information and actually things that they can do right away, strategies to employ. So thank you. It's been super helpful. And thank you so much for joining us today with the Migraine World Summit.
Been my pleasure. Thank you very much. And best of luck to everyone out there and everyone feeling better.
Thank you. Appreciate that.